I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month. Hello and welcome to another very special bonus Q&A episode of Material Girls, the episode type that we have decided to name Material Concerns, because we think it's funny. I'm Hannah McGregor.
And I'm Marcel Cosman, and we are here to answer your hard-hitting questions about...
We're here to answer your material concerns.
We're here to address your material concerns about Willy Wonka, the movie Wonka, Roald Dahl, Twilight, vampire culture, Kristen Stewart, Robert Pattinson, YA novel stuff, and maybe other questions. Totally unrelated. Yeah.
I think we got some, like, really fun, not about Wonka or Twilight questions, and I think we might save those for the second half, the paywalled half.
Ooh, please give us money.
Okay, Marcel, you want to choose our first question?
I do. I want to start with a question from Becky from Wellington. Becky says, I know it's not Wonka, but I can't stop thinking about the fatphobic imagery in the Matilda movie. Big chocolate cake, masculine woman, evil teacher versus femme nice teacher. Oh, sorry. Masculine woman, evil teacher versus femme nice teacher. The story recently became a live onstage production. Why this story? Why now?
It is so, let's say, interesting to me. Let's say interesting as a placeholder for all of the actual complexities of reactions that I have to this. Mm-hmm. The way that as these new productions are attempting to, I think, redeem Dahl's stories for a 21st century audience, mm-hmm. I think it is really revealing what they do, like what they consider to be problematic enough that it needs to be addressed, mm-hmm. and what doesn't need to be addressed, and like how they go about addressing the things that they want to address, etc. So, for example, in the film adaptation of the Matilda musical, Miss Honey is black. And so there's like a attempt to address the overwhelming whiteness of Dahl, to cast the movie in such a way that it like even vaguely looks like the world. Mm-hmm. There's some moments that feel strange as a result, because like so many stories that were written by a white person imagining a world only of white people, when you try to just shoehorn blackness into it, it fits uneasily. So, for example, in the musical Matilda, it's such a, they've added this really weird storyline about Miss Honey's parents being an acrobat and an escape artist who were in a circus. And Matilda is making up a story about an acrobat and a escapologist. And it turns out that the story that she's been making up in her head is the actual story of Miss Honey's parents. Sorry, spoiler. It's a very strange addition. But at some points, Matilda is like fantasizing herself into the place of Miss Honey as a child and fantasizing about being comforted by Miss Honey's father.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a very strange like subbing the white child in for the black child, which visually is quite odd,
mm-hmm.
in the sense of like the connotations of like white women appropriating black women's stories, mm-hmm. and the sort of like history of the appropriation of like the history of, for example, black women having to care for white women's children instead, mm-hmm. of being able to care for their own children. Like, there's these histories there that it feels like the film is, like, not capable of addressing or maybe not even considering.
Mm-hmm.
And I say all of this in part to say that, like, fatness is certainly not the only stumbling block, mm-hmm. of these, mm-hmm. attempted resurrections of these stories or recasting of these stories. But what stands out to me is how little any of the fatphobic storylines change.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how committed these productions remain to the basic premises of, like, fat people are stupid, lazy, pitiable.
Morally corrupt.
Ugly people are bad.
Yeah.
And pretty people are good.
Mm-hmm.
You become, like, that your physical body represents your moral character in a transparent way. So to say, like, oh, well, Miss Honey's black now. Yeah, she is an extremely beautiful black woman who is thin, femme. So there is this kind of attempt to recognize beauty in diversity while a continued commitment to the idea that, like, there is such thing as ugliness, that, like, some people are ugly, and that if people are ugly, it's because they're bad.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that basic premise is, like, such a fucking nightmare. Like, it's so fatphobic, it's so ableist, it's fundamentally racist, like, it's white supremacist, it's all of these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I've really been noticing, like, we had some movement on conversations around fatness in the past decade or so, mm-hmm. and I think that movement has reversed in quite significant ways in recent years,
mm-hmm.
and I think in part, it's also tied to a new generation of weight loss drugs, right? Like the rise of Ozempic, for example,
mm-hmm.
which is incredibly dangerous, has not been studied in the long term for its actual health impacts, you know, is having, like, we don't know what it's going to do to people. What we do know is that for its weight loss purposes, it's like double the recommended clinical dose for blood sugar management, and the second you stop taking it, you'll gain all the weight back, and we have no long-term studies to see what it will do to you if you take it forever. But we don't care because we hate fat people so much. And so, like, it's fine if it might kill you, because it's actually probably better if you die.
Better to be thin than to be fat.
Yeah. Better to be thin. And if you can't be thin, better to be dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, for me, like, underpins these, like, the whale, the fat suits, like, even the little, what's his name, the little kid who eats all the cake and in Matilda. I can't remember his name.
I have no idea. But I haven't seen Matilda in like 20 years.
Yeah, the kid who like they make eat the whole cake. That kid's also wearing a fat suit. So, yeah, it's that's my take on fat phobia.
Yeah. The only thing I want to add is that to me these things stand out as being really conspicuous in these efforts to repurpose Roald Dahl's text for this, you know, new and better world that we all live in. That things like the, like with Wonka, like the fat suit was incredibly conspicuous and really felt to me at least very, I don't know how to phrase this. I want to say out of place, but it's not. It's not out of place in the Roald Dahl universe, but it felt very out of place in the sense of like, oh, are we worse? I thought we weren't doing this anymore, but I guess.
Because like, I think those of us who move in these like queer leftist circles who like are in community with other people who are also like actively fighting for collective liberation,
mm-hmm.
fat phobia is one of the things we are fighting, and we understand it to be like wrapped up with anti-blackness and ableism and like the eugenicist logics of white supremacy. Like, we understand how these things entangle, mm-hmm. and so I think it feels kind of disconcerting to watch something that you know in some sense is trying to pander to you.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's being mm-hmm. like, look at the cute gay twink, look at the diverse casting, look at the, like,
yeah.
look at all of the things that we are doing for you, the now movie-going audience, right? Like, millennials are woke, so we'll make a woke doll movie
woke-a.
For you millennials.
It's woke-a. It's woke-a.
Yeah. And then we go watch them, and we're like, sorry, what?
It's weird, and I don't like it. That's my hot take.
Oh, man. That could really be the conclusion of so many of our takes. You know what? It's weird,
and
I don't like it.
My hard-hitting criticism right there. I got a PhD, people.
Oh,
it's weird. I don't like it.
Weird? I don't like it. Marcel, most of these questions are about Twilight. I'm really sorry, but I am going to ask you this question from Marika, who wants to know about your favorite YA novel or series that you wish more folks knew about.
So I'm hesitant to answer this question because I am often unclear how popular a thing that I have enjoyed is.
I love that about you.
You're
involuntarily extremely offline.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as a result, you sometimes just don't know how famous things are. And mm-hmm. I think it's great.
It's a little embarrassing. So for example, our episode about the Night Circus, in the process leading up to it, I was like, why do you guys want me to talk about this book? And everybody's like, it's really popular. It was really zeitgeisty. I was like, I've never heard of it until I read it.
It was just a weird little niche book that I love.
Yeah, just weird little random book that I happened to find. But then by contrast, I had sort of was under the assumption that the A Marvelous Light trilogy was extremely popular and very famous and very well known. No. It turns out that it's just, not.
Just the
I
gaze.
Told the local queer bookstore about it. Which, you know, delightful. Love to do my part.
Everybody, read A Marvelous Light. read the whole series. They're great.
They are. They're
gay,
so
historical.
So
romance.
So sexy.
Fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Explicit gay sex.
Very, very.
Really so, like, explicit gay sex.
I would say not for under 16. I mean, you
it's
know what?
It's not a YA series.
No. This is not my answer. To be clear, this is me talking. But if you wanted to give it to a if you wanted to give it as a gift, I would just encourage you to make sure the person you're giving it to is like over the age of consent. But if you're under the age of consent, like you get it, go on, get it yourself, kiddo.
Yeah, I'm not going to police 16, what you read. You can read about dicks as much as you want, but I'm not going to give you a book about dicks unless it's a very
educational
our bodies ourselves-esque volume. Yeah.
I'll tell you about it and I'll tell you that it's good. But you get it yourself.
A friend of mine who's a high school teacher recommended recommended the YA trilogy that's like based on Harry Potter fanfic by Rainbow Rowell.
Carry on
and Anyway the Wind Blows and whatever the third one is. Third one might be Anyway the Wind Blows. Who the fuck knows? Anyway, she recommended this trilogy to a student of hers. Having only read the first two, the third one had just come out and she hadn't read it yet. And then she read the third one and there's explicit sex in the third one. And she was like, uh-oh.
Whoops.
Uh-oh.
Ooh, awkward. So the answer.
Anyway, that's not my recommendation because Rainbow Rowell is very famous and everybody has read those books.
So what I would suggest, I have a couple books that I truly do love. One YA series that I have talked about on the podcast before is the Aristotle and Dante series, which is so lovely. No explicit gay sex, but there is implicit gay sex. And you know what? Mm. What more could you want in a YA series? Yeah. And then another one that I'm a big fan of is a book called, and again, this might be very famous. Maybe you've all heard of it. I apologize in advance. In Other Lands, which is...
Oh, I have that, but I haven't read it.
It's so good. I'm trying to read the name of the author from here. And I
it's a white book with a blue mermaid on it. Does that help?
Yeah, I mean, I can see it. I just can't. It's too far away for me to see the
Sarah Rhys Brennan.
Thank you. So in Other Lands by Sarah Rhys Brennan, the main character's name is Elliot. And this Elliot, who uses he, him pronouns, is starts off very, very annoying. Like he's a lot. But the thing is that he knows he's a lot.
But the book spans like multiple years.
That's right. Yeah. So it covers all 7 years of his magical education instead of, say, one book per year. It's very, very clearly in the Harry Potter, in the post Harry Potter like fandom world.
Yeah.
But it's also like explicitly more politically aware than Harry Potter and often deliberately. So anyway, it's his arc is. As he like comes to learn how to trust others because he's such a wee broken lad, is really, really nice. And he's bisexual and like comes to realize that about himself over the course of the book. And it's just really we love bisexual representation. We love it.
We do love bisexual representation.
Mm-hmm.
Man.
That's my answer.
I'm gonna also briefly recommend a series that one is technically not YA, and two, probably a lot of you have already read it. So it's a useless recommendation, but I'm going to recommend Naomi Novik's Scholomance trilogy.
Oh, I read the first one. Yes, yes.
It is a famous really, like, so good. I mean, nowhere near as famous as Twilight, say, but should be.
Mm-hmm,
And very intertextually engaged with Harry Potter as well. So if you are a sort of recovered Harry Potter fan, as we are, a lot of the sort of pleasures of like pretty clear critique of the premises of that world building and a sort of fantasy world building that is deeply engaged with imperialism and class and generational wealth accumulation and power. And that uses magic as a like really smart metaphor for how power operates, which is like my favorite thing that fantasy novels do. And I think, you know, it's not YA because it's quite violent, I suspect, but the protagonists are all teens. So in that sense, it's YA.
Yeah.
It's not actually YA, but I don't. Marcel.
What?
I don't read YA. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, I
actually don't tell anybody.
Don't tell anybody on this public version, on this don't public part of the, yeah. Okay, I won't. I'll keep.
I feel about YA.
Your secret is safe with me, Hannah.
Thanks. The way that I feel about YA is that I will fight to the death for people's right to read and enjoy and critically engage with it.
Yeah.
It's just not my cup of tea.
Yeah.
For the most part, I just don't really care about the internal lives of teens.
I mean.
So I don't like Romeo and Juliet.
I would have thought that's why you do like, you do it because they, you know, they die. They make a lot of bad choices and then they die.
I don't want them to die. No. Hannah's no, take on touche. Teens. Hope they die.
No. Sorry, that's my mistake. That's my mistake. I phrased that very poorly.
Woo! Next Ooh. Question.
Okay, I have a question that I absolutely cannot answer, and so I'm gonna send it to you, Hannah. This comes from Kaylee, who asks about your thoughts on the portrayal of Indigenous peoples in Twilight. Specifically, why does Stephanie Meyer hate Leah so much? And I don't know who Leah is. So this is a question
one
for you.
Woman, the one female werewolf. There's one female werewolf.
Oh, okay. Well, that's my, I should have paid but more like, attention then.
Really downplayed. Like really, really downplayed in the movies. I think most of what we get of Leah comes in the later books, and I've only read the first book. But I will say a couple of things. One is that Stephanie Meyer's use of indigeneity in the series is like deeply disengaged from any serious attempt to think about Indigenous people as people. And is very, very much in the tradition of the sort of J.K. Rowling magic in North America conflation of Indigenous people with fantasy tropes.
Right.
And so Indigenous people are present exclusively to introduce the werewolves and to like introduce this sort of like other kind of magical presence other than the vampires and like the conflict between the werewolves and the vampires, and to represent like, you know, if the vampires are associated with this kind of like old world gentility, you know, they're associated with like European culture, right? Like what they eventually find out about the Volturi, and they're all like European and they have to like go to Europe to like confront them, whereas like werewolfism is like the Indigenous American, virile, earth-based, animalistic, right? Like it's very clearly a set of tropes into which indigeneity fits and is being used exclusively in that sense. And as we understand from the, you know, decades and decades of work by Indigenous scholars, the reduction of Indigenous culture to a set of fantasy tropes is part and parcel with the cultural genocide that North America continues to be invested in, a kind of eternal placement of Indigenous people in the past and or in the realm of fantasy and or in the realm of animality or savagery, which denies the sort of modernity and co-presence of actual living Indigenous people and actual functioning Indigenous nations. And so what I'm saying is that it's racist, but you already knew that. And I will say, like, the particular vilification of Leah is about, like, the narrative function that she plays, right? Like, I think Leah could be put into the same category as, say, like a Tiger Lily figure
from Peter Pan,
which is which is to say that like setting up an Indigenous woman as an enemy or a point of competition for a white woman, again, it's just an old racist trope. Yeah, And I think a lot of white writers just use old racist tropes without any of the education or history to understand why mm-hmm. those tropes fucking suck, mm-hmm. which is why it is like really important, particularly for people who want to write, mm-hmm. to be reading diversely, to be like reading outside authors who have their same histories mm-hmm. and their same backgrounds and their same life experiences.
Yeah.
Because if you're only reading stuff by other people who are like you, then you are also going to uncritically reproduce these tropes. The end.
Yeah, it is certainly not impossible for white people to write about non-white people in a way that is respectful and thoughtful and educated. Oh, yeah.
You write them as actual human fucking characters.
Like, yeah. I think that there is often a misunderstanding this is me being very generous. I think that white writers often mistake inclusion for inclusivity. And that is not how it works. It's like, oh, well, I have Indigenous characters. I'm including them in this world. And that is true, but it doesn't do the work of inclusion if you include them as magical people, magical tropes, etc.
Yeah, yeah. And that the false binary that is set up sort of, I don't know, by bad actors between like either I as a writer should have like absolute carte blanche to mm-hmm. do anything mm-hmm. with anyone with no consequences, or I'm being silenced. And if you say, like, if I, a white man, write an entire book from the point of view of a black woman, and then readers are like, this fucking sucks, dude, mm-hmm. then, like, you are saying that white people can only write books that are entirely about white people and there can't be a single person of color in them anywhere, which is, you know, like, the history of a lot of white literature.
Yeah.
And that binary is, again, like, a fundamentally white supremacist binary.
Mm-hmm.
And can be rejected in favor of the idea of writing good characters.
Yeah.
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 Woo.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month. Okay, I think we got time for one more.
Oh, goody.
And I'm going to ask you, Marcel, about queer slippages. Are you ready to talk about queer slippages?
sounds wet.
Sounds gay. How do we balance to use some Which Please language, queer slippages and possibilities of the text with the way the overarching narrative maintains power structures. I'm thinking of how a surface reading of Twilight upholds being a girl desired by boys slash men as the fantasy and most important experience. How many folks actually experience the more subversive readings or decode compared to the folks who experience the reading that maintains power, the encoded message?
This is
the big, big cue.
Yeah, this
Sorry,
is
the... and that was from
Addie. Thanks, Addie.
Oh, this is Addie Marion's former Which Please guest.
Yeah.
Hi, Addie.
Okay, this is a rich and complex question. And I am not going to be able to, so part of the question I think is more rhetorical, the part where it's like, how many folks actually experience? I don't think Addie is looking for a numerical answer
a
or a percentage,
not.
Right? Yeah. I think that's sort of rhetorical. So I think that the popularity of books like Twilight, books like the Harry Potter series, books like what else is hot that young people read? I have no idea.
Hunger Games.
Great. Aunt Hannah, you're on it. I think that the popularity of these books tells us that there are a lot of people reading resistantly or reading. I'm going to call it reading resistantly. We've talked about this on one of our podcasts before, presumably, maybe not Material Girls yet, but where you as the reader refuse the hegemonic impositions of the text and instead choose to read for those gaps, for those spaces where you can kind of find yourself or find the things that resonate with you. And I think it would be really, really cool if more popular literature just did that overtly and didn't force readers to like to like squeeze themselves in between the lines. But okay, wait, let me go back to your actual question. So you want to know how to balance the queer slippages.
Yeah.
And
like, are we giving popular texts too much credit? I think
is
part
that
of
the
question.
Okay.
Like,
okay.
I think in part, right?
Yes.
Saying like, oh, there's all of these queer slippages in Twilight. Like, here's this radical potential. And then it's like, mm-hmm. yeah, but it's mm-hmm. also this like incredibly heteronormative story
right.
about a teen girl in a love triangle. And that's mm-hmm. like not a particularly liberatory framework.
It's I do think that we give mainstream popular culture too much credit all the time, for sure.
Yeah. You and I specifically.
You
it's like us. Like it's our
the fact that we
world.
Make this show.
Yeah. Like I think us. And I think yeah. it's like kind of part of our like utopian imaginary. That we're like, yeah, there's hegemonic texts, but actually, like, look how gay we can make them.
Yeah. And I don't think we need to stop doing that.
Well, we won't, so.
I don't think we can, but I do think that I really like the fact that we started out by talking about other YA novels and series. I love that that was a question that somebody submitted in the, like, I love that we make space for that conversation and aren't like, well, that's not about Twilight, so we're not going to talk about it. So I think this is my very sort of roundabout way of saying, this is what I think we need to do when we're talking about mainstream, heteronormative, hegemonic works of pop culture that we love, but that are limiting and oppressive in so many ways, and we have to squeeze ourselves into it while we are feeling that love for the thing and talking about the thing, making space to talk about other things where maybe we don't have to work so hard to see ourselves or to be seen by, if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, like there's a difference for me. You know what? A difference so significant that we make two different shows about these different categories. So there's like this difference between the things where I like see myself, like actually see a world in which there is like not only space for me to exist, but space for me to thrive. Like texts like that have this like really important place in my heart. They move me differently. And those texts are almost always written by like queer people, trans people, people of color, like people who are also trying to, you know, imagine the world otherwise. And, you know, reparative reading, restorative reading, resistant reading are like a really vital part of the critical tool set of historically oppressed people. To say like, here's the landscape of popular texts and I'm going to find a way in for myself, or my community is going to find a way to like make use of this for other purposes. And part of the function of that is lies in their popularity, that popular culture is a shared cultural text that we collectively use to think with. And that is part of what makes it a useful place to talk about like queer slippages, for example, and a way to talk about like queerness and queer desire, maybe with people who like didn't see that in that text, who read it without that experience of resistance or exclusion or personal erasure that then causes you to like push against the surface reading of a text. But like, I can bring my reading to you and you know the same text, and so we can use it to talk about together. That's, I think, part of why we like talking about pop culture, is that like, it's a thing that we can use to talk about ideas together.
You know what else I love?
What?
I love taking away power from a shitty author. I really, like, I really, really, I really love perverting characters that the author insists are straight and saying, no, they're not. The text that you wrote makes space for that. I have textual evidence to support this reading. And I am blowing it up in fan art, in fanfic, in like, I don't know, whatever the third thing is between fan art and fanfic. I don't know what it is.
Cosplay,
sure. Yeah.
I don't think it's between, but it's a third thing.
I don't mean it as a spectrum. there is something very satisfying to me about that, especially when that process doesn't, you know, give the author more money. Like I love the idea of trans people reading Harry Potter characters as trans canonically and refusing J.K. Rowling's transphobia and being like, well, you wrote these characters who are literally,
like, in the obviously text, trans.
Literally so, trans.
Yeah.
That's on you, bitch.
Oh, that is on you. All right, Marcel, there are some more exciting questions here, such as a request for an update on how our kitties are doing.
Oh.
But I think that we're going to save that for part two.
All right. That sounds great. If you want to hear part two, you can just walk on down with your, I know this is an audio medium, but I'm doing
it's an audio
little,
medium and you're doing little finger legs.
Doing little finger legs.
Little just, finger legs.
Just walk on down to patreon.com/owitchplease and sign yourself up for a little tier. A little tier is a treat.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And get access to all kinds of good stuff.
We've all had a little cry as a treat, so why not try a little tear as a treat? Okay. Thanks to the team behind Witch Please Productions, and follow some things that are Witch Please. Okay, bye.
Do we do that?
I don't know.
I never remember what we do.
Nope. No, nobody here knows. Bye.